identified themselves as Orthodox.
We identified the broad spectrum of the Jewish community. One of the hallmarks of the Beit Din was that it performed Jewish divorces, for example, for those who were Orthodox, different strands of Orthodoxy, right-wing, centrist, left-wing, Hasidish, Misnagdish, Ashkenazic, Sephardi, and we also served the members of the community who identified themselves as conservative, who identified themselves as a reform, and even people who are unaffiliated altogether. And one of the major benefits was because we were very careful to do everything according to strict halakhic standards. Therefore, whatever would be performed by our Beit Din would be accepted across the spectrum. So you didn't have to worry that there's the way that you would if you simply did something under conservative auspices that it might not be recognized under Orthodox auspices. This way we could have a process where everybody collaboratively and in cooperation would agree that they would go to a Beit Din under Orthodox auspices to be able to take advantage of all of the technological and other resources out there and all the information that was out there. We would all work together so that we would be equipped to be able to issue the halakhic decisions that would enable the widows of these men who had perished in the World Trade Center tragedy to be able to remarry. I remember that the rabbi from the conservative Beit Din said at that meeting, well, we have a simple process in place, so maybe on that level it makes more sense to go through the conservative Beit Din, because all that would need to be established is that a man regularly worked in the World Trade Center, and then they would be ready. They even had a nusach, I think, prepared, a letter, if I recall correctly, a letter that they would issue simply saying, okay, he worked there and he didn't come home, and therefore you can assume that he was dead and we permit the woman to remarry. And we had a more involved process, taking everything into consideration, all of the classical halakhic texts from the Gemara and Yevamos through all of the Rishonim and Achronim and so forth, as to how one goes about establishing without any shadow of the doubt that a man is assumed to be dead, so that the wife would be able to remarry. And after we had this discussion, in which I urged that there be a cooperative process where we could actually take the lead on this, what we discovered in the months that followed is that a number of the is that all of the women really who wanted their cases resolved, whether they were Orthodox, whether they were conservative, whether they were Reform, or whether they were non-affiliated, they all came through to our Beit Din. There were a couple who went to a couple of Hasidic Shabbat they did in Brooklyn, but to the best of my knowledge, there was not a single case that went to a non-Orthodox Beit Din. And I didn't take this as a sign necessary that we were looking to force ourselves upon the rest of the population, but I took this as a sign that there was the possibility that we in the Orthodox community could actually be situated in such a way that the rest of the Jewish population really could be comfortable with us, that there really were opportunities for grander cooperation by sitting together at that meeting, by having that conversation with the leaders across the spectrum, by making it clear that we were available for everybody, that we were prepared to service everybody. The eventual outcome was that we really were able to service everybody. I think it was in that sense a Kiddush Hashem that everybody was able to see how well and how smoothly the Beit Din process worked from a halakhic perspective, and how we were not so myopic or so provincial that we would only serve members of the Orthodox community. And this opens up really the discussion for today, which is what are the parameters of a cooperation, collaboration, working together, serving the broader community, and breaking down some of the barriers between what we traditionally, or what we have grown to be familiar with as the different camps or denominations within Judaism of Orthodox, conservative, Reform, and other types of labels, which to a certain degree have created these separations, some of them real, some of them a little bit more artificial, between different groups of Jews, so that we don't always even think of the possibility of being able to reach out to others. And the halakhic discussion really becomes who is within the Jewish community. So the first source that you start out with, which is the all-embracing source, which kind of gives you the essential premise of collectiveness, of being jointly connected at the hip, if you will, is the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Mem Dalet. The Gemara over there talks about the sin of Achan, how Achan plundered from, in the days of Yehoshua, when they were fighting the wars, entering into Eretz Yisrael, so he plundered from the booty of the war. And Yehoshua found out that he was the one who was guilty, and he was berated, and there were strong words that were mentioned, but in the course of the conversation, he's described as Yisrael, as a Yisrael Chata. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that we see from here that Yisrael Afa Pishachata Yisrael Hu, that as a Jew, even though he sins, we see that he's still a Jew. So from here, this is the common source which is quoted by all of the poskim. If somebody, we see that if somebody starts out Jewish, meaning they're born to a Jewish mother, or they go through a valid conversion process where there really was a Kabbalah mitzvahs in front of a proper bezin. So even if afterwards they backslide, even if a person who is officially Jewish should commit all kinds of sins and averos, no matter how egregious the sin may be, even if they actually convert to another religion, they go to a conversion ceremony to Catholicism or something like that, nonetheless, a Jew is never shorn of his birthright. He's always considered to be Jewish forever. That's the fundamental premise. There are various poskim who questioned as to whether, for example, this source is so compelling, because there's a Maharsh Dam who says, this is in Eben HaEzer, Siman Yud, Maharsh Dam says, well, it doesn't say that Achan converted, apostatized to a different religion. Maybe if he converted to a different religion, maybe in fact we wouldn't say that Yisrael Afa Pishachata is a Yisrael. But despite this observation in the Maharsh Dam, despite the Shita the Bala Itta, which is quoted in the Torah in Siman Mem Dalet and Eben HaEzer, that if you have somebody who became a meshumah to another religion and then he contracts a kiddushin, the kiddushin is not a valid kiddushin because on some level he's not considered to be Jewish at all. We generally don't accept those positions, and we assume for at least two purposes that a Yisrael always remains a Yisrael. Number one, that he's still responsible for any sins that he commits. He's still considered to be responsible, no matter how far he strays. We don't say at this point that you're so far gone that that you have a free pass from now on because you're not even Jewish anymore. And number two, that if he would contract a marriage with a woman, we would say that that he has to give her a get, and otherwise she's still considered to be married because it's a valid Jewish marriage. And his children, assuming he marries a Jewish woman or a Jewish woman herself who converts to a different religion, let's put it that way, and she has a child, so then the child is still considered to be Jewish, no matter how far afield the person has flown. Yes, Yaakov, you had a question.
Yeah, the Gemara actually has that expression, Yisrael Pishchatu, or is that wrong? Does the Gemara actually say those words?
No, the Gemara, the words of the Gemara is Apa Pishchatu Yisrael. It doesn't start out saying Yisrael Apa Pishchatu. I believe it says Apa Pishchatu Yisrael. The full formulation of Yisrael Apa Pishchatu Yisrael, who is not specifically found in the Gemara. It's Apa Pishchatu Yisrael, who is the formulation in the Gemara.
Also, the Gemara's kind of not a theological point, much of a technical point. Now, the Rishonim made it more into
That was the observation of the Maharsh Dam, but the Apal Pikein, it's consistent if you look at the corpus of halakhic literature where we talk about, for example, recidivist geirim, as the Rambam discusses in Perek Yud Beis and Hilchos Yisurei Bia. So he says that a person who has achieved the status of being Jewish, even if they backslide, so they have the status of Yisrael Mumer. And therefore their marriage to a Jewish woman is considered to be a valid and binding Jewish marriage, for example. So militating against this source is the Gemara in Chulin and Daf Hei Amud Beis, which seems to introduce the notion that a person, if they're a very brazen and very flagrant sinner, like a person who is Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia, a person who violates Shabbos publicly, or a person who is a Mumar L'Chol HaTorah Kula, that they just violate all of the laws of the Torah, or a person who's a mumar lahachis, that they may violate only a couple of laws of the Torah, but they do it with a brazen rebellion against the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So the Gemara indicates that the shechita of such individuals may not be a valid shechita. And the Rosh indicates, and this is quoted by the Tor as well in Siman Aleph, Siman Beis of Yoredeah, that the mum, the defect, In all of these cases, is that we say that a Yisrael Mumar, a person who has gone so far afield, is Ka'akumu. Yisrael Mumar Ka'akum. So this formulation is based upon the discussion of Gemara and Chulin. You'll find it explicitly in the Torah. You find it referred to in the Rosh. And this is the mantra on the other side of this of the equation, that if a Yisrael sins so badly and they've gone so far afield that they're not keeping any of the laws, or they're rebelling openly against the Kodesh Baruch Hu, or they're a Mechal Shabbos Bifarhesio, or certainly if they apostatize to another religion, so then they come into this category of Yisrael Mumar Ka'akumu, that we treat the person like an Akum. So these are the tensions, the two extreme parts of the spectrum. On the one hand, the notion that Afa Pishachata Yisraelu, that even though a person has sinned, that they're always a Yisrael, and on the other side of the spectrum, that on for at least purposes of certain dinim, we say that Yisrael Mumar, that a person who has strayed from the traditions of our Mesorah, is treated like an Akum. And then the question becomes, and this has been the question and the conundrum throughout all of the generations, how do you navigate this tension? How do you reconcile these two different opposite poles? If you look in the literature, and there are even some recent Svarim that came out to discuss the areas to which there is an extension of brotherhood to all Jews and the extension to which we say that somebody is outside of the pale, this has ramifications with respect to a large array of different issues, such as, for example, when we say that can you count somebody who's not observant in a minyan? Or, for example, can somebody who's not observant be included in the laws of Arvus? So that they're considered that we would say that if you were Yotzei, a mitzvah, that since they haven't been out, let's say you make Kiddush, and then they ask you to make Kiddush for them, so do we say that you could be motzi them in the mitzvah? Are they included within Arvus, within the ability to say that since this person hasn't fulfilled their mitzvah, it's as if I haven't fulfilled my mitzvah? Do we say, no, they're outside of the pale? Or, for example, with respect to the question that we know that a non-Jew can make, through the touching of wine, can make the wine into stam yenim, so that you're not supposed to touch the wine because of the concerns. If you have an idolater, if an idolater touches wine, so that turns the wine into yayin esech, because maybe they would use it for libation purposes, and even if we say that we don't think that they're necessarily full idolaters, but at least it would have the status of stam yenim. That we don't know that they used it for libation, but maybe they had the intention for libation. And do we apply that same principle to non-observant Jews? Do we say that if somebody is so far removed, they're a Mechal Shabbos Perfahesia, like the Gemara says, where it's Dino Ka'akum, where we paskin that the person has a halak on some level like an Akum, so do we say that they're an Akum with respect to these different dinim as well? And here you will find two very different strands of thought among the poskim, even among the last couple of centuries, with respect to how you deal with these issues. There's the much more tolerant and lenient camp, I suppose you can call on the one hand, and then there's the much more uncompromising camp on the other side. So the tolerant camp looks to a couple of sources to say that maybe not everybody who is so far removed, or somebody who is unobservant of Jewish law, even if they are Mechal Shabbos Befarhesya, we don't necessarily say that they are beyond the pale of our immediate concern or our immediate focus. This is in part premised upon a statement that the Rambam makes, and the Rambam is talking about the Tzidukim, which was a sect that essentially only adopted the Torah Shebichtav and not the Torah Shebaal Peh. So they went off and they didn't really observe anything properly. And the Rambam says that for the children of such individuals who don't know any better, and they were just following in the ways of their forefathers. The Rambam is in Hilchos Mamim, Perek Gimel, Halacha Gimel. So the Rambam says that they're essentially like what he calls a tinok shenishba. It's like a child who at a very young age was taken into captivity and did not to live among an observant population, and therefore didn't know if I'm observant, so therefore you cannot assign the same type of moral condemnation to such an individual. So while we might say for somebody who's an apikoris that if they fall into a pit, you're not going to even bother to take them out of the pit. So he says, so we wouldn't say that with respect to this type of individual. We wouldn't say that we would lower the person into, that we would do, the expression is maridin below malin. So we wouldn't say that with respect to somebody who was in this category, because it's just, okay, it's b'maisei avoseihem. So while not everybody accepted this view of the Rambam with respect to the contemporary populations of their times, because some said, well, if you look at the Jews who are not observant, so they know that there are observant Jews in the universe, and they're not going along with them, so therefore how could you call them Tinok Shenishba? But others relied more expansively upon the statement of the Rambam to say that you can view such Jews as Tinok Shenishba. In addition, the Chazon Ish, in his comments to Yoredeya, in Simon Beis of Yoredeya, the same Simon that we were discussing earlier, also has a couple of comments, I believe in Sip Tezayin and a little bit more in Chaf Ches, where the Chazon Ish says that you can really only completely write people off entirely as rebels against the tradition when you were living in a time in which the Shekhinah was more revealed to everybody, where you looked around you and you saw Nisim and Niflo, so there was no question in anybody's mind in terms of the mindset of the population regarding the presence of a Kaddish Baruch Hu in worldly affairs. But he said that in contemporary times where the world has become much more complicated, it's become a much more skeptical and heretical world in general, where people don't appreciate the obvious presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where the Shekhinah is much less revealed under these circumstances. So the Chazon Ish said that you also have to have a more compassionate view towards Jews who are not fully observant, that you can't just write them off entirely and say that we're just going to leave them in the pit. And therefore the Chazon Ish says that the appropriate stance and attitude towards such Jews is to try to bring them back, avoso shel ava, that you should bring them back with cords of love rather than to write them off entirely. So based on this type of traditional perspective, yes, I'm sorry, you have a question. I thought I saw your hand go up. Okay, please feel free to ask questions. So based on this type of perspective, there's a famous tshuva by the Binyan Sionis, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. So Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger wrote a tshuva about this whole question regarding a Mechal Shabbos Befreheskia, somebody who is a violator of Shabbos who touches wine. And do we say that the wine becomes prohibited as Tam Yenim, that we treat the person like an Akum? And the Binyan Sion starts off by saying that he thinks that you can make a strong argument that we're machmir with people who have lesser offenses than being mechal Shabbos, even people are just who are mechal hamodos, mechal cholamoy, we would make the wine prohibited. So certainly somebody's mechal Shabbos for Heskia. But then he ends off with this tremendous limutzchus, in which he says, but you know what, this really only applied when people were mechal Shabbos in a way that showed that they were kofir bibori, that they were denying the existence of their creator, the presence of their creator in their lives. But he said a lot of the people in his time were Mechal Shabbos, so they had tremendous stresses of Parnassa. They didn't fully appreciate, because they lived in a time and already where observance was becoming less universal. So they didn't appreciate that it was necessarily a contradiction to Shabbos for them to go in and work. They would first make Kiddush. They would go and daven in an early minyan in the morning. They would go and they would come home and they would make Kiddush, in which they would say all the words about how Hashem runs the universe and how we created Shabbos, and they would acknowledge all of this reality. And then they would go off to work. So he said that since they were making Kiddush and they were acknowledging their creator, so therefore he didn't think that they fell in the classical mode of Mechal Shabbos for Behesia, but rather they came into the category of what might be referred to as Tinok Shenishba, As the child taken into captivity, as the Rambam had discussed, and certainly their children who don't know any better and who see this routine, he thinks would come into the category of Tinek Shenishpa. So he said that those who are Mekel, those who are lenient based on this type of approach, Yesh Lehem Amin Lismach, they certainly have what to rely upon in terms of being lenient. Now it happens that this tshuva of the Binyan Tzion was published posthumously, which means after he died, and he had authored this tshuva at the time that he himself published his original volume of Shailos HaTshuvos, but did not see fit to include this tshuva. So when his son published the posthumous volume of the Binyan Tzion, the son said, there were a number of tshuvas that my father didn't feel were appropriate for publication, lemaise. They were not lahalacha lemaise. They were not intended as being an absolute halachic guidance, and people should please not rely upon them. And he has a whole collection of tshuvas which are prefaced with the heading, Apsakim Shelo Lahalacha Lemaise. These are Apsakim that are not halacha lemaise. And this is the very first tshuva in that section, so that it actually, if you look in this tshuva, so the Binyan Tzion, the heading over this tshuva is Psakim Shelo Lahalacha Lemaise. It's not specifically appended to this tshuva, it's appended to the whole section of which this tshuva is the very first one. But one important lesson whenever you're going to publish a tshuva from a gadol is that it doesn't really matter if you put a heading that says Shelo Lahalacha Lemaise. People see that this was a thought process that the gadol had, that the posek had, so people will come to rely upon it. And in truth and in fairness, the son himself in his hakdama to the Binyan Tzion says, even though one should not rely upon these tshuvas, if somebody wants to use them as a sniff, as a consideration, or as, you know, something to take into account in deciding some other case that comes before them, and these tshuvas can be helpful, so then I feel that I have provided a tremendous service by making this tshuva available. So it's not entirely the case either that this tshuva was not intended to be looked at or utilized in any fashion whatsoever, even by the son. Is that the point that you were going to make, Yaakov? And so I think that even the son in the Hakdam, if you read the Hakdam carefully, seems to be acknowledging that as well. And in fact, this Binyan Tzion was relied upon by subsequent poskim, such as, I'll take your question in a second, of David Zvi Hoffman, who when dealing with the question as to whether you could be mitzarei for Mechal Shabbos before Hesia for a minyan, which is continues to be a vexing question at Hayom Hazeh. So some quote the fact that the Samanim in the Ketores had the Chelbona, which was a foul-smelling a spice that was included with all the others. So we see that you can include even those who may not have the fragrant smell or odor of those who keep all the mitzvahs, that they also could be included in the Maharshan. A famous comment that is appended to the very end of Maseches Krisis says, actually, if you count up the Samamonim carefully, you'll see there are 11. There's the Chelbona plus there are 10 others, so therefore it's okay to include them as long as you have a valid minyan without them. And he actually has that discussion over this. So the VNC of David Zvi Hoffman says, well, based on this thought process, the Milami Lahol of David Zvi Hoffman says that based on this process of this thought process of the Binyan Tzion, thinks that that could be a tremendous sniff, a tremendous consideration in terms of being lenient. He doesn't recommend being lenient lechatzila, but if one is in that situation, he thinks that one could rely upon this argument of the Binyan Tzion in terms of feeling that one has been yotze, their obligation of davening with the minyan, even if they have a Mechal Shabbos Perpehesio, what he says, Bizman Hazeh, where there are people who are not fully appreciative of the enormity of the prohibition of doing work on Shabbos, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're outside the pale. And if you look at the heading of his particular tshuva, the heading even makes note, kind of, everyone is pushing the envelope one step further, the heading kind of makes note that these people are not only Mechal Shabbos, but they don't even make Kiddush. But despite that fact, he still felt that they still fell in this general category for what the Binyan Tzion was talking about. Yes, what was
just
your question?
Just a comment, which is just on the question I had. The Chabon was also a small portion of it also, so is there a limit as to how many that people have in a minyan also?
Yeah, he was talking about having even a couple. I mean, perhaps there are two or three. He was talking about as a possibility. In terms of majority of the minyan, there is a notion of keeping the majority intact that some of the posts can talk about.
So my question was, wouldn't it be especially relevant when an apostate, Yanin, Stam Yanin by an apostate?
wouldn't that concern be very relevant?
It is very relevant. That's what we're discussing. What do you mean?
That's Mechal Shabbos. I'm saying.
Oh, you're saying if somebody's an apostate, you're saying that it's that you actually have a fear of libation. Well, you would have it. The question is whether you would have it to the same degree as the rest of the population. This discussion regarding the Stam Yenam was not focused purely on the apostate. It was focused upon specifically the Mechal Shabbos before Hesia case.
Right.
Well, I think that this group of poskim would not have been lenient in the case of the apostate,
right.
of the person who actually converted to another religion. These leniencies that we're describing would not be applicable to that situation. Yes?
If you have a conservative reform person come to an Orthodox based in, and you know that if you give them a ruling that they're not going to like, that they're just going to not listen to it and use the conservative approach, are you still allowed to be the poser for them, or you're like, is there any difference?
So it's a process. You know, the very fact that a person comes into your neighborhood, that the person actually is standing there and they've joined with you, at a time in which many of these affiliations and categorizations, and I think the late Rav Avraham Shapiro made reference to this as well, at a time in which they become much more amorphous and vague and people kind of travel from place to place, what happens is that you don't have a mark upon you like, you know, the sneeches that some people have, you know, stars and some, you know, don't have on their on theirs. There isn't necessarily a permanent badge that a person carries with them. They're reform, they're conservative, you know. So once a person actually becomes comfortable in a certain setting, if you do have an acceptance of all Jews as brethren, in accordance with this type of approach that was espoused by the Chazon Ish, for example, at least through the source that I gave you, then you'd be surprised at how some of these barriers fall away. And it's not just a question of the person's not going to listen because they're from a different affiliation. If they're there, they already become part of you. For purposes of this proceeding, for purposes of being comfortable with the process of, say, the resolution of the Aguna cases after the World Trade Center, or the process of a get, if they feel comfortable coming to the Orthodox Beis Din for the get, so they just become part of the Beis Din, they become part of the process. You don't have the rebellion, because once they're in the door, they already then become part of that movement for this aspect of their lives. People are complicated, and sometimes people are defined by where they are at that moment in time. And that's also something to be very cognizant of, that I don't think that people walk around with permanent badges wherever they're going. A person could be brought up a particular way. They come to Yeshiva University. They become part of the Yeshiva University community. We don't look at a person differently because they happen to be raised, say, in a Reform household or in a conservative household. These don't carry with them these, you know, permanent markers, you know, that they once did. If a person was outside of Judaism altogether, they were brought up in a different religion and they want to join the Jewish community, they have to go through it with a conversion. We don't say the same thing with respect to a person who was out to who was brought up Jewish. A person was brought up in a different religion who happened biologically and halachically to be Jewish, so there is a procedure known as Divrei Chaveiros that the Ramah describes of going into a mikvah because they were actually practicing a different religion. But otherwise, these other, you know, movements, denominations, affiliations are not actually described as or considered as different religions. So this is one strand, and you find this very tolerant and embracing stand really described very eloquently with all of the relevant sources by a recent sefer called Reacha Kamocha. On the other side, though, there was an approach that was very much in opposition to the Binyan Sion and to Rav David Zvi Hoffman, and you can find this approach epitomized more in the writings of the Minchas Olozah, the Munkacharov. The Munkacharov, in a very strongly worded tshuva in Chelek Aleph Siman Ayin Dalet of the Minchas Olozah, talks about the same situation. I'm sorry? It's in Chelek Aleph Siman Ayin Dalet of the Minchas Olozah. So he talks about the same question as to whether to be lenient with respect to a Mechal Shabbos touching wine. And he goes to the opposite extreme and says that in a time in which you have a much a higher degree of not observance and where to the and to a greater increasing margin of the world of Judaism, people view this as normative. You have to take stronger stands against this type of activity to make it even more clear that it's not normative. And without using the terminology, I would say precisely, he pretty much concludes with the statement that there's a mitzvah in a time of rampant assimilation to engage in richuk rechokim, actually take those who have been far away and to keep them as far away as possible, even suggesting to the argument that might be made that the whole problem, one of the arguments made to be lenient is that the concern with Stam Yenim is that you're going to intermarry, and if the person's Jewish, you don't have to worry about intermarriage because you're allowed to marry them. So he says, well, he thinks there is a prohibition of intermarriage with those who are Mechalei Shabbos Befarhesia. So he makes reference to the tshuva of the Binyan Tzion and throws in at least a parenthetical in his tshuva that he thinks that whoever published the tshuva and made clear at the heading that it was Pesachim Shalol the Halacha Lemaisa did a wonderful service because he doesn't think it should be Halacha Lemaisa at all, but takes a very strong exception even to the suggestion of the Binyan Tzion that the fact that the people actually made Kiddush is a mitigating consideration. He said, what does the Kiddush mean when to be Mekadesh Shabbos is all about observing the laws of the Shabbos and recognizing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu rested and we should be resting, and if these people think that they can go out to work and that's how they're going to observe Shabbos, of what value is this type of a Kiddush? So he takes a very, very strong stand, essentially, really, of the trepidation side of the equation, of being worried that too much tolerance could lead to a backsliding even of those who are observant. Too much tolerance, too much kinship, too much fellowship could actually lead to an untoward influence towards those who really are trying to be observant, and those who ever can get a hold of the video clip that was discovered and is sometimes played of the Minchas Elazar exhorting his followers to strengthen their commitment to Shmira Shabbos and not to be influenced by the Chil Shabbos going on in society around them. This incredible clip from something like 1915 or so that was taken and that you can find, who knows if it's available on YouTube. It's on YouTube, okay. It's worthwhile watching, actually, because you can capture a tremendous amount of the passion and the essence of the message that was being conveyed by the Minchas Elazar, and it's important, you know, to take that into account as well. Those who are part of what I would call that camp of attitude towards these types of issues will look at some of the sources that I mentioned with a little bit of a grain of salt. The Rambam was talking primarily just about how we don't lower these people into a pit anymore, and the concluding words of the Rambam, which you won't find in old editions of the Rambam. I actually looked this up. I had an edition of the Rambam, the two-volume leather-bound edition that I got, you know, as a bar mitzvah present, which does not have the concluding words at the end of Perek Gimel and Halacha Gimel of Hilchos Mamrim. It doesn't have a certain three words that do appear in the Frankel edition, but if you look in the Frankel edition, the Rambam's entire dissertation ends with the words Be'al Yimahir Lahorgan, and therefore you shouldn't be so quick to kill them. So this camp would say, look, the Rambam was just saying, don't be quick to kill them. But if you really examine them and you see that they're completely off of the off their rocker and that they really have gone astray, then, you know, the Rambam isn't even necessarily eliminating that possibility either. And those in this camp will also point to the Chazon Ish and say there are other places in the Chazon Ish. The very, very beginning of Yoredei, I think in Siman Aleph Tesai, where the Chazon Ish appears to take more of a case-by-case nuanced approach, and this isn't necessarily saying that across the board every single person has to be given the benefit of the doubt. He's saying that as a general matter, it's possible that those who have become Mechalei Shabbos and gone astray and aren't observing mitzvahs sometimes just don't know any better, and you have to bring them back with cords of love, but it's not necessarily a universal proposition. Yes?
The old editions of the Rambam do or don't have the language?
Don't have the language. And the new editions, the Frankel edition of the Rambam, again, I don't know. I haven't looked at every single edition of the Rambam. Some of the old editions of the Rambam don't have the language, but the new editions of the Rambam clearly do have this language. And therefore, the sources, you know, could be sometimes looked at both ways and could cut in both directions. And they also will point to the comment of the Radbaz on the Rambam, when the Rambam was talking about the Tzidukim, or those who lived in completely completely isolated communities from the observant Jewish community. And the Radbaz says that this is inapplicable to Jews who live in observant settings but choose to be Mechal Shabbos, because they can look around themselves and they really can know better and do better. And this is a general critique which is leveled by a number of poskim against the argument of Tinok Shenishba. Tinok Shenishba sounds like somebody's really taken into captivity and is not exposed to the world of observance. Now, the others can say, no, the Rambam is basically saying that Oksim and I say Avosam, they don't know better because they're following their parents' ways and they have a tunnel vision with respect to what they consider to be normative based on their upbringing. So therefore, the fact that they know that there's a new square out there, or they know that there are from Jews or Orthodox Jews out there, is not necessarily that comes into their sphere of vision, and therefore you can't necessarily condemn them for their complete lack of observance. So you have these two disparate camps. And the question is there any way of bridging them? Do you pick one or do you pick the other? So there are a number of personalities in recent times who kind of made what I would call a pshara between the different approaches of saying, well, on the one hand, you have to recognize the fact that those who are not observant are not completely within the pale of orthodoxy for purposes of inclusion in everything. And sometimes you have to maintain an insular distance in order not to backslide from your own ways. And you have to keep your institutions clear and pure and your processes purely halakhic, and sometimes bringing them into those processes could have dangers. But on the other hand, we still should not abandon them entirely, and we should not cast them outside of the scope of our responsibility towards our fellow Jews. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, for example, drew a distinction between what he called friendship, which should be available to all Jews because they're all part of the same broad mishpacha, that you should be friendly towards and you should take care of their needs and you should engage in atzalos nefashos if they're ever in trouble and make sure that the poor across, you know, the all of the lines of Judaism are taken care of. And what he called fellowship. Fellowship, you go and give someone a fellowship. A fellowship is something which is much more circumspectly distributed, where you have to determine who are the people you're going to eat with, drink with, hang out with. When you're talking about hanging out with somebody very comfortably and very cozily, those are the people who are going to have the major influences on you. Then you have to choose your cohorts more wisely, and that you would reduce or you would restrict to a more observant population. And the Rubs, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik's famous distinction that he delineated, it was originally in a Yiddish language journal in 1954, where the Rav made this distinction between being involved with members outside of the observant, immediately observant community with respect to klapei chutz matters. Klapei chutz are basically the same matters that I was describing in Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's categorization of dealing with social issues, dealing with economic issues, dealing with issues of religious liberties from a governmental or political perspective. So these types of issues, the Rav defined as klapei chutz, where you could work together with other denominations, you could work together with Jews of other creeds and other dogmas in terms of crafting approaches that would be to the benefit of Klal Yisrael as a whole. And he used that very poignantly in his argument. After all, Hitler didn't differentiate between one type of Jew or another. They were all sent to the crematoria. But on the other hand, the Rav said, when you're dealing with klapei pnim, when you're dealing with issues that have to do with ideological and halachic decision-making within Judaism, so these were areas where the Rav felt that we needed to be more insular. And one of the major hot-button political issues of the day in the 1950s was the question as to whether the various Rosh Yeshiva were going to issue a blanket prohibition against the rabbis participating in the Synagogue Council of America, because the Synagogue Council of America consisted of a combination or an amalgamation of Orthodox rabbis, conservative rabbis, reform rabbis, and the conservative and reform, of course, were not completely halakhic either in their practice, or even if in their practice they were halakhic in their ideologies, certainly they differed from traditional halakhic Judaism. A number of poskim, including Rav Moshe Feinstein, including Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, including even within our own camp of David Lifshitz, signed on this this ban, basically stating that rabbis should not participate in the Synagogue Council of America. The Rav did not sign. This was a source of controversy, and the source of controversy to this day is to how to interpret the fact that the Rav did not sign. From various correspondence that's been published of the Rav Soloveitchik from around that time, it would appear that the reason the Rav didn't sign was because he did not want to alienate a significant segment of the Jewish population. He did not want to cut off ties that he felt were beneficial and were important for the Jewish community as a whole, to just give a blanket condemnation. On the other hand, he also didn't come out with a ringing endorsement of this type of participation, because fundamentally the Rav believed in observing this distinction between klapi chutz and klapi pnim, and this was not a distinction that was necessarily so carefully observed, or where it was not doctrinally ordained that it should be so carefully observed within the confines of the Synagogue Council of America. So there was kind of this tense standoff where the Rav simply dealt with the situation by not joining in this particular document, and trying as best as possible to educate his own disciples to follow in the ways of his very carefully calibrated categories. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his tshuvos, takes this kind of pshara, or this kind of fusion of the tensions from both ends of the equation into a more legalistic application. But Moshe Feinstein basically said, and you find this a couple of places, I'll give you the sources. You look at Ebn Ezer, Chelek Aleph, Simon Pei Beis, in Sif Katan Yud Aleph. But Moshe, especially in his earlier days, used to write enormously long tshuvos, sometimes with 11, 12 anafim, branches. This is in Anaf Yud Aleph. And in Anaf branch Yud Aleph, there's a final paragraph that starts with the word Ve'amina. And Rav Moshe also has this in Ebn Ezer, Chelek Dalet, Simon Lamed Beis, Sif Zayin, in which Rav Moshe basically distinguishes between a sense of compassion and a sense of non-judgmentalism against those who are not terribly observant. I mean, those who have gone off and have affiliated with other movements. Rav Moshe has an understanding that the fact that somebody grows up in a conservative home or a reform home does not mean that they have made a dogmatic decision that they are following the ideology of that movement. They're just born into a certain community that isn't so observant. It's not as if they have such strong ideological grounds that they have a need to reject Torah Min HaShemayim or anything like that. They just grew up in a certain setting. So therefore, he has a much more compassionate view towards these individuals in general. However, Rav Moshe says that as a legalistic matter, if a person really is completely non-observant, a person really practically is a Machal Shabbos B'Frei Heskia, even if we're not going to condemn that person, even if we are going to extend the brotherhood to that individual, as a practical matter, he says, they're just Pasul Eidus. Says that if you're looking to bring Kosher Eidim to for a Kiddushin to be valid, for a get to be valid, so you need to have individuals who, just on a very practical perspective, are ma'aminim, who are people who observe Shabbos and who observe the mitzvos. If from a practical perspective they don't observe the mitzvos, so then we can't treat them as kosher eidim. And in that one felt swoop, Rav Moshe did something that was perhaps the most compassionate approach towards everybody that he could have, possibly come up with, because on the one hand, he preserved the notion of a feeling of brotherhood with all aspects of the Jewish community. And on the other hand, he also saved them from what could have been a terrible epidemic of mamzerus, because what was happening in that community is that they weren't getting divorced with proper gittin. Sometimes they would have no gittin whatsoever. The women were getting remarried and having more children. All of those children would have been mamzerim, but Rav Moshe was able to say, well, look, since as a practical matter, when they're getting married, they're getting married using witnesses from their own community who are not Shomer Shabbos, or rabbis who are not Shomer Shabbos, or who are not believers in ideologically in the Yud Gimel Ikarei Emunah. And Rav Moshe gradually came on in his tshuvas to arrive at a categorical rejection, pretty much, of those who were non-Orthodox rabbis, because of the fact that they were officially affiliating themselves with movements whose ideologies did not accept all aspects of Torah Min HaShemayim and the essential ideological components of Judaism. The Rambam, in his Hakdama to Perek HaChelek in Sanhedrin, says that anybody who does not accept the Yud Gimel Ikarei Emunah is not part of Klal Yisrael, which is also part of this discussion. To what degree do you categorically reject somebody who doesn't have all the Emunas V'deos? The Rashash in Masechet Shabbos says that if a person doesn't have all of the requisite Emunas simply because they're unsophisticated, so they don't know anything, because they, like the Ger went in front of Hill, said, I only accept Torah Yeshebetav and not Torah Shebaal Peh. Rashash says, how could he be accepted at him? So he says, because his rejection was not based on a sophisticated analysis of Hashkafa. He just didn't know anything. So if you don't know anything, so then you're not really a kofer in matters of ideologies. That's also part of the discussion. Rav Moshe feels that those who affirmatively assume these posts of Rav Moshe feels that, at least in terms of being pasul le'edus, this is an area where that you certainly would come to that conclusion. And therefore, since the marriages, says Rav Moshe, of these people were never kosher to begin with because they didn't have kosher witnesses, therefore, b'dievet, if they didn't have proper gittin, then we're not going to declare children of subsequent marriages of the woman who didn't receive a get from such a marriage to be mamzerim. So this also was a tremendous compassionate result that came out of this bifurcated analysis between the culpability of the sinner on the one hand and the reality of the sinner on the other. Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, and throughout the course of the discussion, the Rav has been speaking mostly with regards to where less religious people would be like conservative or reform. In the Sephardic communities, though, it's very different, where like, you see, a person who's not religious still affiliates himself with the same shul. He doesn't, they don't go out and make their own shuls with their own rabbanim. As if they still, they're like, oh, they'll come like maybe just for Shabbat. They'll drive to shul on Shabbat, but they still affiliate themselves with the same community. Now, how would it play out differently with regards to that?
So it's a good question. There's a famous article that appeared in a tradition a number of years ago by a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Howard Levine, and it was entitled The Non-Observant Orthodox. And he spoke about the phenomenon of people who belong to Orthodox congregations but who themselves were not personally observant. And he urged, he made the argument that those individuals who at least were affiliating themselves with Orthodoxy, even if they had not fulfilled their full aspirations of their affiliations, nonetheless, the very fact that they were affiliating themselves in this fashion, and that this was where they found their own personal fellowship with their fellow Jews in an Orthodox setting, should cause us to view those individuals with more of a compassion and more of a sense of inclusion than those who did not even choose to affiliate themselves with the Orthodox community entirely. So that was an argument that was already made by Rabbi Howard Levine. And in the course of that article, Rabbi Levine actually made another point, which I think is just worthy of mentioning, which is that he said that that when you look at this set of individuals, even if a person is not fully observant in all ritual aspects of Judaism, the reality is that there are many ethical halachos of Judaism in terms of not cheating other people in business and doing things of that variety. And he said that those who are in the community, at least that he was describing anyway, were people who whose sense of their Judaism was also a strong sense of ethical conduct, of the ethical aspirations and rules of Judaism, as Hisa HaYashar VeHatov and so forth, and that one could not discount these moral indications or these moral manifestations of their observance as being something which was not relevant to defining them as observant as well, and that when we define observance, you have to look at the totality of the picture, and that some people are deficient in certain ways and other people are deficient in other ways. Now, it happens that there are certain types of deficiencies that are considered to be particularly egregious in terms of our definition of the person for inclusion in Klal Yisrael or for Psulei Eidus, such as somebody who is a Mechal Shabbos before Hesya. And certainly that is one of the reasons why we're specifically identifying that area. But he pointed out that you could have somebody who's very careful in kashrus, but who's cheating everybody in business, and somebody who's very careful in business, but not as careful in kashrus, and it doesn't, and we shouldn't view one of them as observant and one of them as not observant. They both are a little bit observant and a little bit not observant, or a lot observant and not a lot not observant, but that this should not be discounted from the discussion either. And I think that's very important as well, because that brings me sort of to the last leg of the discussion when we talk about the Orthodox community. The Rav Kook complained already going back a number of years that he worried about the fallacy of a labeling. He was talking about the labels that existed in Eretz Yisrael about 100 years ago of labeling certain segments of the community as these are the Haredim, and these are, in those days, it was called the Chofshim. Liosam Chofshi. These were that would be sort of the negative, interpretation of the term. Chas v'shalom, it's not, what we mean when we sing it. But but he said the Haredim and the Chofshim, labeling people in these categories was a terrible, sent a terrible message to both groups. Because it said to the group that was labeled as Haredim that basically everything that you do is fine because we're calling you a Haredi, so therefore you must be without fault altogether. So therefore they would have no aspiration ever to do tshuva because there's nothing to do tshuva about. They're already Haredim. And with respect to those who are labeled as Chofshim, they wouldn't have any aspiration to ever come back to the fold or to become more observant because they would feel like they were like Acher, that they were beyond the pale. They're already being called Chofshim. They're already being called Chilonim. So he said that it's terrible for both populations. So he advocated that if we're going to break up Jews into categories, rather than having Haredim and Chofshim, and I guess in our own context, rather than delineating people in terms of Orthodox conservative reform, so he advocated going back to the old model of Tzadikim, Beinonim, and Rishayim. That's the way that we should be magdir everyone. Everyone should see themselves as a Beinoni, that they are half Sukhuyos and half Chofos, and every single action of them will affect the outcome of the judgment of the world. And that's the way that everyone is supposed to really view themselves. So the truth is that the whole category of Orthodox, really, as Rosh Shimshon Fall Hirsch points out in an argument in an article that he wrote called Religion Allied with Progress, was almost itself an artificial creation so that the community of those who were more observant and who were following more in the traditional paths of the rabbis who have been guiding them from Moshe Rabbeinu and so down to their time differentiated themselves from the radical innovative movements that have been created by those who call themselves reform or who call themselves later on conservative. So in order to differentiate themselves, they needed to call themselves Orthodox. But itself, he didn't like the term because it implied that one is as good as the other. That, oh yeah, you can just pick one of them. Not that there's one authentic branch and the others are not authentic. So therefore, he really didn't like the label Orthodox either at all for that reason. In recent times, the Mordechai Gifter was a champion of not being wedded to the term Orthodox, and he preferred to utilize the term Torah Judaism, which showed more of the connection between one's observance and one's adherence to the Torah than using these terms, to the extent that we still in this day and age continue to utilize terminology such as Orthodox in order to define ourselves. I think it's just because it's being done in order to differentiate ourselves from all the confusion that abounds sometimes when people get up and they say that a particular practice or a particular approach towards life is quote unquote halachic, but without any kind of guidance from some authentic, proven tradition of rabbinic guidance of from the Rosh Yeshiva of one's generation or from previous generations and so forth. So in order to at least provide some sort of term or terminology for those who are following a particular tradition, who are going in the ways of their rabbis and following the ways of the Mesorah, and not just independently creating some kind of artificially generated movement, the term Orthodox is utilized so that a person can demonstrate that they are part of that traditional camp, that they take their instruction from a certain accepted set of rabbinic leadership, whether it was Rav Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, or whether in our generation it's our wonderful, you know, Rebbeim here at Yeshiva University, and everybody kind of understands who are the enterprises and the entities that are within that general camp. But in terms of just the general skepticism and fear and the trepidation of the like that was expressed by the Minchas Elazar and others of being influenced by the other camps, I think that something very fundamental has changed in the recent decades. And that change is that Orthodoxy, or the movement that is more committed to the Mesorah of Judaism and to the Torah traditions that have been passed down from generation to generation, has actually become much stronger. A lot of the fears of being drawn into the conservative movement, a lot of the fears of being led into the free liberal reigning spirit of the Reform movement are not as pointed today as they were in the previous generation or previous generations. Or those who are within Orthodox Judaism are in a much better position, or much better perch. Those of us who are here at Yeshiva University are much better perch to be a positive influence towards the broader Jewish population. And those who happen to wear certain affiliations don't wear them with the same ideological badge that may have existed 100 years ago when these movements were first set up. Even the conservative movement doesn't necessarily find a strong adherence by its younger generation to an acceptance of this particular affiliational status. There's declining numbers in their membership. Those in the Reform movement don't get so ideologically crazed about what the movement stands for, and you even find efforts to inject more observance within that community, and there's just much more of an openness, I think, among a broader population to be led and to be educated and to be brought more into the world of observance. So therefore, to the extent that there are opportunities for intersection that can be conducted with the Orthodox taking the lead, where everything is done under proper halakhic auspices, like, for example, the educational conference that was held here at YU, which last year, which included elements of the non-Orthodox community that are involved in the education of the next generation of Jewish children. And these events can be overseen and can be planned by Orthodox authorities with the hope and aspiration and intention of being able to bring everybody closer together, then I think that we do have newfound opportunities to engage in that enterprise, albeit gingerly. I'll just conclude with a statement by the Pardes Yosef, who is for one of the commentators to the Torah, who was a Gera Chassid who lived in pre-war Europe and was unfortunately killed in the Holocaust, but he has a wonderful Perush Al HaTorah. And this Gera Chassid, who is a top-rate Talmid Chacham, and I highly recommend his Sefer, also has a number of philosophical and societal observations that are peppered throughout his work. And in his commentary, I believe Parshas Bo, which is upcoming, he has a brief sidebar discussion about the state of the Jewish community and those who have become less observant, and he simply enunciates his own perspective that he feels, and this was a very from a Ger Chassid speaking over here, that he feels that even in that era there were opportunities, greater opportunities, for bringing people closer than for writing them off entirely. And the phrase that he used to express this particular ideology or aspiration is Tov lahachayos milikvor. It's much better to resuscitate people to life than to bury them. So if we have the opportunity to resuscitate our brethren to life, to resuscitate ourselves, resuscitate our entire community, to be stronger and to return to the model of Neged Ahar, as we discussed at Har Sinai, Yichon Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, Ki Ish Echad V'Lev Echad, that we should be able to return to the pristine state of a Jewish unity that occurred at the time of Kabbalah's Torah with a commitment to Kabbalah's Torah across the spectrum of the Jewish people, that in Yetzir Hashem, we should do certainly whatever is within our power to bring that about, to hasten the coming of the Mashiach. M'heira v'yameinu. Amen.
Amen.